Hi, I'm Sharon Davis, Chief Executive of Young Enterprise, and welcome to our podcast series, Transforming Futures. I'll be talking with special guests from many different walks of life, all of whom have fascinating life experiences and a shared commitment to helping young people build successful futures. We explore how the powerful chemistry of support and opportunity has shaped their own lives, getting their individual takes on future skills needed across a range of industry sectors, and what more we can do as a society to help young people build and apply those skills. My guest today is Alan McQuaid, Head of Transfer Solutions, one of MasterCard's key business units responsible for products such as MasterCard Send, cross-border services, bill pay, and pay by account. Previously, Alan was Chief Business Development Officer of CLS, the global foreign exchange settlement utility. Before then, he had a distinguished legal career as General Counsel of CLS and Barclays South Africa Corporate Investment Banking and as Global Head of Transactional Legal at Dresdner Kleinwort. Hello and welcome to Transforming Futures, Alan.
Hello, great to be here. I'm very excited to chat.
My first question is one that I ask all of our guests. Now, at Young Enterprise, we often talk about the chemistry of support and opportunity, having the power to literally transform someone's life. What does that sentence mean to you personally?
It means a lot. It resonates personally, hugely with me, having started off in a different part of the world to where I now live in a different sort of career. My life has transformed across a number of dimensions. And in every single case, really, that's come on the back of somebody choosing to give me an opportunity and choosing to support me in some kind of transformation. We constantly emphasize training and skills, and for sure, you need that groundwork, and it is half of the story. But in my view, looking back on a longish to long career, we tend to emphasize training and qualifications, skills, and they are incredibly important, hard to get hired with absolutely no clear skills whatsoever. But we do, I think, tend to ignore the other half of the story, which is that in order to step up, in order to become what you aren't today, typically somebody has to take a chance on you and recognize that you have potential to do something else or to step to another level, to go from being a manager of one person or two people to 100 and maybe 1,000 or more. And why does that happen? Well, yes, there's part of it being it's a reward for your hard work and dedication and people recognizing that you're ready to step up. But I would say it's just as much about finding someone who has chemistry with you, who has identified with you and become invested in you and your journey at some level, because that's the person who has the power and position typically to make the change for you. So yeah, completely important and completely relevant to my journey.
And listening to you just there, talking about someone taking the chance on you to step on to another level, investing in your journey, reflecting on your own journey today, Alan, can you share a couple of moments where early on in your career that's happened and shaped your career?
I would start by saying that I grew up in Cape Town in South Africa. And even there, my legal journey started with working in a very small two-partner firm. And at the time, I made the decision to come to London at the time and to apply against what seemed like very steep odds, this sort of top law firm in the world and me with no financial markets background. It seemed very unlikely. And I think that the fact that I was one of the few selected in their recruitment drive across South Africa was really largely because I had immediate chemistry with someone that was sent to do the sort of reconnaissance. But I think, you know, that was a bet on a hire. It was pivotal to me, but one that's even more, I think, based around chemistry was when I went to Dresdner Kleinwort. I had a very small team, and for various reasons, it was decided to move 80-something percent of the global legal team into an entirely new function and to find someone to lead it. And that was handed to me. And that was very largely because somebody had become my mentor and my sponsor and remains a friend. You know, gosh, it must be 15 years since I left that job, but I remain friends with that person. My job at CLS, when I transformed my career from being a general counsel to being a head of a business, really, with it was actually a moment of insanity from the CEO when I look at it. I mean, appointing a lawyer, we're very good with words and not very good with much else. Choosing someone like me to build a strategy unit and a product house and sales function was entirely a bet and an investment in capability and a trust in me. And that was an entirely personal decision, again, from somebody that remains a friend to this day. So, and there are more instances, again, even my role at MasterCard, the decision to hire me into the role running a pretty big slice of the business wasn't actually what I came to MasterCard to do. I came to do a piece of pretty narrow consulting. But again, my current boss, just after a few conversations and a bit of time working together, just decided I was the person that they wanted. And that was, again, chemistry and his read.
And if we unpack chemistry in terms of your experiences, is that empathy of your situation? Is that recognition? Is that wanting to open the door for you? How would you define that chemistry?
Yeah, so this is a topic that I always get a little bit nervous about, because I think, you know, chemistry is very closely aligned to identifying with someone, and that can, at a, you know, if it's done superficially, that can be just identifying with a type, with somebody who looks and feels and sounds like you. And, you know, anybody who is vaguely aware of unconscious bias knows that that's a dangerous game. If everybody just gives opportunities to people that, you know, look and sound like them, or go to the same golf club, or like the same sports, or whatever it may be. So I think you have to check yourself for that, both as a manager, and but even in building your own career. But I think when I think about chemistry, I'm talking about actually being unafraid of building a discourse with somebody that gets to a deeper level of understanding their values. I think work ethic plays into it a bit. I think being prepared to cross the boundaries into sharing humor is an important part. Maybe that's just my personality. I shouldn't generalize, but for me, I can't help it. I get on with people that I can laugh with. It's just built in. So I think there's a lot of that. But to come back to what we said at the beginning, look, this connection is part of building connectivity and respect for the output, you know, and that comes with hard work. It comes with applying skills in a practical way that makes the life of your boss easier. All of those things sort of happen together. But you have to pack your fear away, is the thing I'd say, on both sides of a relationship like that.
That's interesting. Packing your fear away. Tell me a little bit more about that. Tell me more.
From the perspective of a younger person whose career is growing, you know, sort of putting yourself out there with more senior people and exposing your vulnerabilities, it's all very well to be vulnerable when you're at my stage of my career, because, you know, you're a sort of natural safe place. You've achieved a large part of what you need to. And so being vulnerable becomes a strength. But when you're at an earlier part of your career, that can be terrifying. It's difficult from that side of the relationship. And then from the person that's actually investing in you and taking a more personal interest, there are all sorts of pitfalls you need to watch out for. You know, you can't step across into being invasive with someone. You know, someone might be an introvert who doesn't really want to have deeper conversations. You know, again, you have to worry about perception. You can't exercise favoritism. You know, this is subtle stuff, actually, building a really personal connection in the workplace, and choosing to do it, but doing it fairly and appropriately is not easy.
And listening to you, I hear you talking about work ethic. I hear you talking about there's an element of being able to take risks, that very first application to Clifford Chance. What would you say your superpower skills are that you'd credit your journey to date with, and how did you go about building them?
I think my superpower skill in life, and this is going to be very off the wall for a career chat, But I think it's about connecting, reading people and accessing and connecting with them at a deeper and more vulnerable level. I think that's true in my work and personal life. And I try not to be a different person at work and at home. I don't have two different personas. And maybe that's one of the things. I think very early in my career, I made the decision to be totally open about what I am, what I'm good at and what I'm not good at, and left it to other people to decide. You know, you spend a good part of your career faking it, I think. Well, maybe I was just unlucky. I certainly feel like I've spent a good part of my career faking it. And, you know, if you do that with too much bravado, with too much faking it, with not enough honesty about, you know, where you're at, the internal strain, should I say, of pretending all the time is just will overwhelm you. So there's a balance of faking it, but being open to be hit. And then I think the last thing is as a superpower, and I would recommend it to anybody that wants to succeed in the workplace, is a tendency to introspect. And what I mean by that is every time that something goes wrong or could be done better, or that a relationship has gone wrong in the workplace, or even just that I'm thinking this department is full of idiots or this person is an idiot or whatever, and I'm just looking out across a line and getting ready to blame someone else, I always look to myself, and I've taught my team to do the same. It's like, okay, if this relationship is broken down, even if, you know, put in the supposition, even if it wasn't your fault, what is the thing that you could do better to avoid it? So that's what I mean by introspection, looking at yourself first for improvement, rather than just getting frustrated and pointing fingers at everybody else. Modern workplaces are frustrating, complex places. And if you go in thinking that you're right all the time, you'll run into a wall.
And just listening to you, and we are going to move on to future skills in a minute, but one last question for you really, Alan, is just listening to you making a decision early on in your career about bringing your full self, utilising your complete energy and not basically being one person in work and one person at home. What made you make that decision, and what benefits have you then seen by making that commitment and taking that risk?
When people talk about South Africans, they like to generalize that we're really upfront and direct. I think it's a bit overgeneralized, but it's not entirely wrong. So I come from a culture that tends to sort of say it like it is. People tend to be relatively relaxed with what they are. So I think I've benefited from that a little bit. I should say this is not without hazard. When I think back to the early part of my career, and again, this is maybe a watch out for people early in their career, I tended to be very outspoken. And I think I got that wrong quite a lot when I look back. When you come out of the maybe schooling, university, I think it's really healthy that you're opinionated, that you have certainty about yourself and about things in the world. And I think I went into the workplace with a lot of that and was ready to speak my mind. And when I look back at it now, I'm pretty sure that I came across too self-assured, a little bit arrogant. So I place a caveat in terms of be your authentic self, but don't be, you know, there's probably no polite word, smarty pants. Can I say that? Nobody likes somebody who's always trying to be right, making points for the sake of it, and kind of just feeling entitled to be the center of attention. So there are, when I say feel, you know, be free to be yourself again, it's slightly nuanced. Obviously, you moderate how you come across, and you have to be sensitive to the fact that you're in a workplace with other people bringing their own selves. So I'm not saying just go in and turn up and shout your mouth off and do what you want. But I am saying that there is a level of fear at admitting everything about yourself that can really hold you back.
And you've balanced that, haven't you, when you talk about the importance of that introspective checking in with yourself first before blaming others. I mean, that's clearly something that you've developed a long way as well.
Absolutely right. And look, I'm very conscious that I'll give you a really silly example. So I like electronic dance music, and it's tragic at my
electronic
age.
Electronic dance? That's not like house, still. Is it? Is that something different than house?
Well, even deeper than house. Now, again, I'm at the edge of, at the stage of my career where I can say that, and I frankly don't have to care what anybody says. But when you're younger and you pitch up at work, it's, I think everybody feels like they are X or Y. They have to be X or Y type of person. You know, first prize for them is that they went to Oxbridge and have that qualification, or they've done this MBA, or and they have to be a certain type of person. So admitting that they like thrash or trance or, you know, whatever it is, whatever their thing is, you know, that's quite difficult to do. But my advice is don't let go of what you are. If people aren't going to connect with that, then do you really want to be in that environment? For what it's worth, me personally, but also I would say MasterCard as an organization, when I really don't want to depress or downgrade people on qualifications or the right path to impress employers, but I absolutely do not look for which university, for, you know, which MBA. I'm much more interested in people that are interesting, that have managed to succeed, maybe with lesser qualifications, where the feedback from previous people they've worked with is about them turning up, being passionate, being loyal, and having an applicable skill set. That kind of authenticity of what someone actually is, as opposed to what their CV says about them, is much, much more interesting.
And so that importance of building your own story is critical for a young person listening to this now and thinking, how do I go about making my way? And that's something I know MasterCard really value, is that growing talent and driving diversity and inclusion into every part of the business. You know, how essential is it for MasterCard to engage young people at an early stage to drive diversity and inclusion into your future workforce? And what impact are you seeing that focus have on your organisation?
Unsurprisingly, it's a core part of everything we think about in talent. You know, we start really early, for example, with Girls for Tech, which is our STEM curriculum for 8 to 12-year-old girls. And now there's a version 2 aimed at the slightly older 13s to 16s, working with mentors that we have to develop new tech innovations. So there's a whole lot of stuff there. And then everything on the career journey, from early career hires, so internships, as you would expect. We have a launch program for graduate development. There is special onboarding, there are training boot camps, there's on-the-job training and mentorships. I think the critical thing is that we have a culture of promoting growth and opportunity, rather than saying, here's X qualification fits Y role, get in your box and good luck. It's about letting people build their own careers, and that's in terms of skills, but also in terms of the connectivity we've been talking about. So we've got an opportunity network we call Unlocked, and that is partly about roles, but it's also about mentors, volunteering. We've got guilds and learning academies. So just super focused from the very beginning in getting young talent through the door. But again, not saying, right, you have this qualification. We've gone to market for people from that university that's created a scarcity, you know, identity for itself. And no, we're much more interested in taking people and being part of their development journey and creating a sort of interesting career path, because otherwise we won't retain them at some point. It'll just become a comp discussion and someone else will grab them. You know,
and as we look ahead to the future of your industry, what changes do you anticipating happening in your sector?
I sometimes look at what's going on every day at work and think our sector is about nothing but change. Like, it's almost odd to say what's gonna be different in 5 years, because nothing's the same as it was yesterday. We're a sort of bit of a dual identity company, in the sense that we're a technology company, but we're in payments specifically. So we're also a payments company. And to talk about payments in general, I'd need an hour, honestly, to talk about it, because there's so much there. But if I had to narrow in on one part of it, I'd say that payments and technology will continue getting closer and closer together, and that payments will increasingly be integrated into everything else that we do in life rather than being a thing on their own. And what I mean by that is, you know, not that long ago when you had a payment to make, you thought, okay, I've done X, now I need to go make the payment. Then you would think about going to your bank, or in the old days, writing a check. It would be a sort of different experience for payments. Whereas now, you're typically doing something else, whether you're in an app, in an online store, and you don't really even, that's just the end of a process of your shopping trip. It's not really a separate thing. Making that more and more integrated and simple, whether that's facial recognition or whatever, is going to be critical. And then I'd say aligned to that, the journey of payments and the journey of creating identity, like transferable identity, I think that will continue to get closer and closer. I sort of imagine a future where you don't really have a means of payment. You just have your face or you or whatever. But identity is a really complex question in terms of privacy, in terms of recognition across borders. It's a really, really tough puzzle to break down. So I think that's where payments are going. And so naturally the skills that go along with it are, you know, everything to do with digital fluency. And that involves specialization in security and fraud, engineering skills, complex problem solving, obviously AI, because you won't have a fintech or technology discussion without talking about that. That's certainly at the core of coding and experiences. But I think there are other things we mustn't forget, like technology hits the road at some point. So skills in dealing with customers and customer centricity and understanding the customer journey, those will still be core.
At Young Enterprise, we're increasingly focused on the role applied learning plays in helping young people build that skills, the confidence and mindset to be able to make that contribution, whether that be to their communities or future productivity. And a good example of that is our partnership with MasterCard, delivering the Innovation Studio Challenge, where young people are solving a real-life business challenge set by MasterCard. What more do you think the finance sector can do to help young people access more applied learning opportunities as they transition from education into work?
I think there are two dimensions to it. One is the sorts of programs that we are undertaking. So anything to actually engage with learning institutions and engage with young people while they're going through their formal education to actually teach them the difference between, you know, textbook subject matter and what it's like in the workplace. So there's outreach from institutions like we're doing it. And then I think there is more of building that into the curriculums as well. So schools actually arranging and teaching those skills. I think it's absolutely fascinating, this topic to me, which is, I mean, there are different challenges for organizations at different scales. So like fintechs have, you know, the need to be able to ideate, to crisply explain and sell a story around a proposition and then get investment and then hire people that can build quickly, right, and get something to market. So, but when you come to the finance industry more broadly, and I'd say this probably applies to banks, it applies to companies like us, there are plenty of people that have ideas. There are plenty of people that have engineering skills and product skills and all of the things that it takes to deliver something. So that, what is it then? What is this thing that we could be doing better? It's about managing complexity, change management, managing ambiguity, and bringing together stakeholders. So managing opinions, managing debate, choosing paths forward, and actually turning all of that into execution. So that's why things like a challenge where you actually have to learn to work in teams, learn to compromise your idea that you clearly think is the best because there's more buy-in to somebody else's or it's more executable or more within your budget. All of these little compromises that are the secret to an organization being agile and effective. Those skills are again, I don't want to say more important, but I think in an organization, there are fewer people that have the skill of bringing things together and managing learning to apply it than there are people that have sort of core technical skills, if that makes sense.
It does. It absolutely does. And that ability to be able to translate that knowledge, as you say, to execute the plan is becoming more and more important. And it's certainly of critical importance to young enterprise. And we're really proud of the work we're doing with MasterCard. Well, I think we're nearly at the end of our time together. Alan, I can't let you go without asking you this one question. What's the one takeaway on your journey so far you'd share with a 15-year-old Alan to help him on his way?
Can I have two? I do think the first thing is to realise very early, particularly if you're bright and full of ideas, that it's very easy to be so clever that you end up being stupid, by which I mean, like, it's more important if you've got a good idea to build relationships, get people on your side. You don't need to win an argument. Most arguments, if you walk away from them, it wouldn't matter at all. So just pick the things where you need to win a debate, because it's actually going to affect the outcome. But for the rest, just make friends and get on with people, because that will take you further. So that's one. And the second thing is, don't prejudge what you might be good at. I always knew I'd be a good lawyer because I'm relatively articulate and I can reason well. But the other things that I'm in, I had no interest in business when I was young. I still don't really know how to qualify in strategy, but I run all of these functions and I found out that I was good at it along the way. Same with managing people. I initially in my career, I didn't want to manage people because I thought I was so argumentative, no one would work for me. That turned out to be very wrong, and I think I've learned to be good at it. So don't prejudge that. What that might mean is, as you're trying new things and as you're stepping out, you're going to have real imposter syndrome. You know, you're going to feel like you're faking it. And let me first of all reassure you, everybody feels like that. I came into my job at MasterCard a year and three quarter ago. And even in this role, at the pretty senior end of my career, I've spent probably the first year completely full of imposter syndrome, because I was sitting over new businesses I didn't understand, having to describe them at a pretty senior level, having to lead people that have more subject matter expertise than you do. It's kind of terrifying at some level. Don't be afraid of it. If you're completely out of your depth and you're screwing it up, of course, shout for help. But just realize that most people in an organization are pretending a lot of the time. And actually, the ones that just sit there and grin and pretend and don't reach out and are scared of being vulnerable, they're actually the ones most at risk. Those of you who are prepared to take chances, to swallow that imposter syndrome, to reach out for help, to be vulnerable, to be clear about what you need and what you don't, you're much more likely to succeed. So don't be afraid of being afraid. It's your friend.
Alan, it's been an absolute joy to talk with you today. Thank you so much for being so candid in sharing your own experiences of imposter syndrome and just so authentic in sharing your own journey. But thank you also for investment and your personal support and that of MasterCard, providing young people with opportunities to learn more about making sustainable choices and developing skills across the board. It's been an absolute honour. Thank you, Alan.
It's been a great pleasure talking to you, and thanks from me personally and from MasterCard. We're both hugely aligned and supportive of everything you do.
Next week, I'll be speaking with Rian Kelly, Chief Sustainability Officer at National Grid, about the often overlooked skill of being able to provide clarity to describe complex things in a simple, accessible way, and why it's important to have the courage to grasp the opportunities in front of you. Look out for that podcast, which will be available next week.